This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Critic Alex Ross recently wrote, "It seems as though we are living in a world scored by Steve Reich." Starting today and continuing through the end of the month, three of New York's major cultural institutions, Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, and BAM, are mounting a huge tribute to the composer. There will also be major events at the Whitney Museum and at London's Barbican Center, and Nonesuch Records is releasing a 5-CD set of some of his best-known works. Why all the hoopla? Well, today is Steve Reich's 70th birthday, and he joins us in our WNYC studio. Steve, happy birthday.
Thank you very much, John.
So how are you celebrating this year?
Well, I'm going on the air on WNYC with my old friend John Schaefer to start it off right.
And then it seems like you're just hither and yon for the next month.
It's actually about a couple of months, yeah. I've got to go back to London and then back here and then to Japan and then back here and then to France and Portugal, and I won't bore you with the rest.
The thing that seems to be missing, though, is the underground dance party because, you know, let's face it, there are tons of techno artists and DJs and rockers whose music you've influenced over the years.
Yeah, I remember I was in London in 1992, and a guy from one of those pop keyboard magazines was interviewing me. He said, "What do you think of The Orb?" And I said, "What's that?" He said, "You don't know?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you ought to know." And he gave me this CD, and I took it home. And there's 30 seconds of Electric Counterpoint played by Pat Metheny. And I thought, well, these guys aren't like Brian and Eno. They don't just like my music. They just, like, take it. But I was a good guy. See, I didn't sue. And so I guess I got a good rap in the field. And so people have come back for more.
and The Orb had a big hit with that song.
Had their biggest hit with that song.
Right, yeah. That they made out of your Electric Counterpoint piece. So for many years, you have not just been, a fine composer and a good friend to WNYC. You've been a neighbor. You lived across the street.
That's right.
Now you're up in Westchester. And
way up.
That's a big change for you.
Yeah, well, you know, the neighborhood has, when I came here in 1965, there was no World Trade Center. There was a vegetable market. It was called the Washington Market. The word Tribeca didn't exist. There were a bunch of used hardware stores and potted plant stores. It was like living in Hoboken. You felt like, well, I'm going to leave the city and go home. And now it's like 40-story towers and constant construction and, millionaires only allowed and a lot of noise. I used to walk out on the street every day with earplugs in my pocket and, mm-hmm. Sort of gird myself for the onslaught. And that gets to you after a while. So I also had a place, as you know, in Vermont, and used to realize, hey, I get more work done in Vermont than I do in New York. Why not, sort of quiet the whole scene down? So we did.
So the quintessential downtown composer has moved way uptown, but if people are thinking that this is going to signal like a new pastoral phase in your music, your new piece, The Daniel Variations, will disabuse them of that pretty quickly, I would think.
A lot of people think, Vermont Counterpoint. Well, most of it was written in New York, and New York Counterpoint was mostly written in Vermont, and City Life, a lot of it was written in Vermont. So, the imagination is that, it's the setting sets it off. Well, maybe in your mind, but not in your physical location.
Right. So tell us a little bit about The Daniel Variations. The work, this is your newest piece, and you've brought in kind of a MIDI, a computer mock-up of some of the piece.
Right. Well, what happened was I was out in Los Angeles in 2004 rehearsing UR Variations with the Los Angeles Master Chorale. And the woman who runs the chorale, Terry Knowles, said to me, "Would you like to meet Judea Pearl?" And I knew who that was. That was Daniel Pearl's father. And the next day, sure enough, he shows up at the hotel, and we hit it off right away. And he said, "Did you know my son was a musician and not just a journalist?" And I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Well, he was a violinist, a fiddle player, if you like. He loved bluegrass, he loved jazz, and part of his whole life was to jam with people, and that's how he made a lot of his journalistic connections. And we're starting a foundation in his honor, and it's got two purposes. Number one, intercultural understanding." And I thought to myself, wow, what a tzaddik, what a saint. If my son was beheaded, I don't know if I could do what he's done.
Right.
And the second thing he said is our purpose is music. He said, we started off just having Daniel Pearl Music Days, which is asking people who are giving concerts to call it that. But now we want to actually commission someone to write a piece in his memory. Would you be interested? I said, I'd be honored. And I explained to him I had already been commissioned by Carnegie Hall and the Barbican to write a piece for my own ensemble, the Music for ATN Ensemble, which has four voices in it. But I said, in that piece, they kind of go up, do, 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 kind of imitating the sound of the instruments, but they don't really sing. And then the new piece, as yet unknown, I wanted to have the turnaround and sing words. And I said to Julia Pearl, I think you're bringing me my text. And he smiled and he said, probably so.
So you went to some of the writings of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal, the American journalist who was kidnapped and eventually beheaded
right.
by Islamic militants, and it was in
Pakistan. 2002, yeah.
So you're using some of his words and some of the Book of Daniel, the biblical Book of Daniel.
Right. Basically, when I'm back, I've been thinking everybody whose name is Daniel, in a sense, is named after Daniel from the Bible. And I'd never read the book. It's very late. It's about 500 years before Jesus, and it takes place in Babylonia, i.e. Iraq. And the king of Iraq, Nebuchadnezzar, takes Jews from the land of Israel, especially the intelligentsia and the people he feels are useful to him, and brings them back. And I could tell you a little bit about how I got to, you want me to run down how I got to the text?
Well, why don't we hear a little bit of the piece first?
Okay.
Do we hear, this is a MIDI version, so it won't have words.
No, you won't have any words.
But this is some of the new music written by Steve Reich, and taken from the piece called The Daniel Variations. Some of the music of my guest, Steve Reich, from his forthcoming piece, Daniel Variations. All right, so Steve, the texts, how did you come to them?
Well, I was reading the Book of Daniel, and in the second chapter, Nebuchadnezzar has a real bad dream. And he can't interpret it, and his dream interpreters and magicians can't interpret it. And it's a little bit like Pharaoh and Joseph. And he hears about this young man, Daniel, who's kind of a visionary. He calls him in, and he says to him, and the words are more or less, I saw a dream. Images on my bed and visions in my head frightened me. And when I read it, I got a chill down my spine because I live four blocks from here, which is four blocks from the World Trade Center. And I wasn't here on 9/11, but my son was, and my granddaughter was. And it was a terrifying day. I mean, we had a six-hour phone conversation just making sure that he got out alive, and my granddaughter got out alive, and thank God they did. But it's not the kind of thing I'll ever forget so long as I live. I studied Balinese music and have Balinese friends, and went to find that, that Balinese, the most friendly people on earth, were bombed and burned alive because they're Hindus, that kids in Beslan in Russia, because they're Christian, or were held hostage and murdered, that statues, Buddhist statues in Afghanistan were blown up. That dream that he had is unfortunately really a picture of the world that we're living in. I mean, you can put your head in the sand, but if you take your head out of the sand, then you have to see that. So I said, okay, that's the first text, and that's going to be set not at all like what you just heard, which is the second movement. Pretty dark, pretty percussive, pretty heavy. And then I said, okay, now to the words of Daniel Pearl. And Daniel Pearl's father gave me a transcript of the actual murder, not the videotape, but the transcript of the words. And one of the things that they had him say is, my name is Daniel Pearl. I'm a Jewish American from Encino, California. And I just, that's the name of the second movement, but the text that I choose to set within that is just, my name is Daniel Pearl, which is a little bit of what you just heard.
So the melody, the way he said his name is determining the contour of the melody?
No, there's no tape involved. It was just a transcript, okay. Just words on paper. I'm setting the whole thing. But my name is Daniel. What a name is that? It's like, it's like some banner, It's like a perfect name, and people say your name is indicative of your character. So it's just, he was a fiddle player. So as you can hardly tell on the MIDI, but I mean the strings just take off, and I added two strings to my Music for 18 ensemble so there would be more of them. And so he switches character from minor dominance to major dominance, and the fiddles just, say, okay, Daniel Pearl is here.
Mm-hmm.
Third movement is goes back to the Book of Daniel, and it's Daniel's response to Nebuchadnezzar. And he says very succinctly, let the dream fall back on the dreaded. And that's set very percussively, very, very much like the first movement. And the last movement, the text is a little bit out of left field, and it says, but I sure hope Gabriel likes my music when the day is done. So what's that? Well, when this book of his writings, Daniel Pearl's writings, was edited, they broke it up into chapters about things. One of them was music, and each chapter had a little preface, and this is prefaced by a friend. A friend's name is Tom Jennings. apparently he and Danny were old friends, and they'd gone on a camping trip together. And, you know, they're having dinner, and the friend says to Danny, "Hey, Danny, what's going to happen to you after you die?" And Daniel Pearl says, "You know, I don't know. Who knows?" And then he pauses, and he looks the guy right in the eye and says, "But I sure hope Gabriel likes my music." And the guy thinks, you know, "I'm not going there." And he just drops the whole thing. Okay, cut to 2002. Daniel Pearl is murdered, and this guy is still a friend of his and a friend of his family. And the family says to him, "Tom, would you do us a favor? Go to Danny's apartment and, you know, be a big help to us pack things up." He says, "Sure, I'll be happy to do that." Goes to the apartment, and Daniel Pearl, being a musician, has this huge record collection, and it has a lot of old vinyl LPs. And in front of one of them is Stuff Smith, the old black jazz violinist, Stuff Smith and the Onyx Boys, 1936, first tune, "I Hope Gabriel Likes My Music." Written in 1936, never heard of since. So I went to my publisher, Boosie & Hawkes, and I asked him to get me the lead sheet, and I got it. And I looked at it, and I said, "I'm not using the music, I'm not using the words, and I'm even going to change the title, but it's irresistible, and it's such an up." And parenthetically, just a little footnote, when there's a dream that's going to affect a whole lot of people, like Pharaoh's dream or Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the angel who transports the dream from its source to the recipient is Gabriel. He's the messenger. Mm. So I thought, this piece has got his name on it.
Well, and literally it does, the Daniel Variations. Yeah. Getting its premiere where and when?
The first performance is going to be in London on the 8th of October, this Sunday night, and then the American premiere will be at Carnegie Hall, October 22nd at St. Cal Hall.
All right. My guest is Steve Reich. We're celebrating his 70th birthday, which is today. He's my guest on Soundcheck, and we've put together a pretty special web page on the WNYC.org site with archival shows going all the way back to 1981. Steve, you and I did a show here for your 50th birthday.
Oh,
that
my.
Was 20 years ago. That's there. You can download a free MP3 of Steve Reich's classic piece, Music for 18 Musicians. There's a concert calendar, a timeline of Steve Reich's career, some photos. Interesting thing is there's a photo of you and I from this 1986 show. Your head is uncovered. That doesn't happen anymore. What has changed in the 20 years in regards to your own like religious practice?
Well, my son got very involved in Judaism and a lot. Then actually went back to being a rock and roll musician, which he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
But a certain amount of it rubbed off on me. I got friendly with Michael Gordon, the composer from Bang on a Can, who's an observant Jew, and he always wore a baseball hat or some kind of hat. And I thought, gee, that's perfect. I'm comfortable with that. I can do that. And the idea in Judaism is that there's these rays, sort of divine rays, coming down at you, and to sort of, you know, show a little bit of humility in that, in the force of that, yeah, traditionally we cover our heads. So the baseball hat was a very easy way to deal with that, both on stage and off. And so at that point, I started adapting that practice.
Mm-hmm. And Jewish themes have you know, been evident in some of your work, at least,
yep,
over the last 20 years or so. Of course, there was Tehillim, setting of psalm texts.
That was way back in 81, yeah.
Right. And then The Cave, which is also being performed at Lincoln Center as part of this 70th birthday celebration. Now, you started that piece during the first Gulf War. You finished it around the time of the first World Trade Center bombing.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
So it was a completely different world. You look at it now in light of all that we've seen and heard about in the last 5 years, and, you know, what do you think about The Cave now?
Well, I think The Cave is unfortunately still very, very relevant. I think that the interviews with the Palestinians may be a little... It's the time I wrote the piece... Salman Rushdie was under threat of death. And so I wrote the second movement of the Muslim movement with the feeling of both hands tied behind my back and a knife at my throat.
Mm.
And so I think it's a little inhibited and a little bit afraid to face some realities that we've seen after that time. So perhaps it would be a little bit more realistic if it were done today, in terms of portraying the Muslim attitude towards the West.
Mm-hmm. So the idea behind The Cave was this, you know, the shared connection to Abraham.
Yes, that
among
is,
Jews that, and Muslims.
And Christians.
And
yes.
Christians.
Yes.
So you went to the Middle East, you interviewed Israeli Jews, you interviewed Muslims, Palestinians, you came here and interviewed Americans.
That's right.
and asking them all, who is Abraham for you? Who is Hagar? Who is Sarah? And here's some of the results from Act 3 of The Cave.
He caused a lot of trouble.
Lord says he's going to be a wild man.
Driven away with his mother.
Driven away
with his mother.
He's sort of the James Dean of the Old Testament.
Some of Steve Reich's music from The Cave, which is a big music video work, multimedia piece, to use the current buzzword, right, with Beryl Corot. And this work, a good example, Steve, of something that you have pursued throughout your career, starting with the earliest tape pieces in the 1960s, the idea of the hidden music in our speech and being able to kind of extract that.
Well, as people listen to us, you know, I may be living in northern Westchester, but you hear the sound of my voice and the speed of my voice, and you think this guy must be from New York City.
Right.
So, in a sense, a recording of a person is as much their soul, their being, as a photograph is of their person. So that reality, when you set text, well, okay, you're setting words and you have to make a melody, but if you're setting a recording of a person, you're really setting a human being. You're setting them and their personality and their words, especially in The Cave and Different Trains, where I never altered it at all, really determines the emotional character of what's said, because that's how they said it.
Right. Now, it's interesting to hear you say that, you know, if you were doing The Cave today, it might be a little more realistic, maybe a little more politically pointed or whatever. Yeah. At some point, you do run into this. I mean, politics is a big thing, and it's hard to kind of move it to one side or the other when you're trying to make a musical point.
Right.
At what point, you know, are you serving two masters and not serving either one well?
Prima la musica, the Italians say. First the music. When you first heard Bob Dylan, did you understand a word he said?
Nope.
But there was something about him, right? And you said, What on earth is this guy saying? And you went back and you found out. And then when you found out, you said, hey, this guy's a great lyricist. Mm-hmm. This is really interesting stuff. Well, it's the same with The Messiah. It's the same with The Cave. It's the same with any piece. If the music drags you in, if the music magnetically pulls you, then you will go and try to find out what the words are about. And the same holds true. So basically, whatever your political views, their importance lies in how that gets the composer excited, how that gets the video artist excited. That creates a work where the music and video are hopefully successful. If they are, the political stuff will live. If the music and the video are not, the political stuff will die with it.
Steve Reich is my guest. We're celebrating his 70th birthday. We'll take a quick break and continue our conversation. And heading into the break, we have, Steve, a piece that many regard as your masterpiece, 1976 recording, Music for 18 Musicians, played by Steve Reich and musicians. Reminder that we have a special webpage at WNYC.org with archival shows featuring Steve Reich, New Sounds Live concert with Steve and his musicians. There's an MP3 file of this piece, Music for 18 Musicians, that you can download. There's also a concert calendar, photos, and a timeline. Check out WNYC.org for our special page celebrating Steve Reich's 70th birthday. Still to come on Soundcheck this afternoon, a live performance from the Brazilian Girls. The electropop band will be joining us in just a little while.
I had to, open the bruise up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them. come out, to show them, 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 come out, to show them.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. My guest is composer Steve Reich. It's his 70th birthday, and he's spending some of it with us here at WNYC. Steve, we were talking before the break about things like, you know, the inherent music in speech, and also, you know, prima la musica, as you say. You can have political or social views, but it's how you present them that will determine the success of a piece. This is one of your earliest works, Come Out. And, you know, when you take just a tiny little snatch of speech like this, It becomes abstract, but there was a real, I mean, this is the beginning of the civil rights movement, there was a real social context to this piece.
Yeah, the voice is the voice of Daniel Hamm, who was one of the Harlem Six who were arrested for the murder of a white woman in 1964. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to do a bunch of tape editing as part of a benefit for their retrial with a lawyer of their own choosing, and back in 66. And I said, well, I'll do it if you let me make a piece out of it. And they said, well, what do you mean a piece? And the guy was Truman Nelson was the guy who asked me, and he was a John Brown scholar. So I played him It's Gonna Rain, the earlier piece on the Black Pentecostal Preacher, and he said, hey, that's really interesting. And I thought, well, you know, if you're crazy enough to like that piece, you know, then you'll like this piece too. So out of this hours and hours and hours of tape of police boys and mothers and so on and so forth, I heard this one phrase, had to like open the booze up and let some of the blues blood come out to show them, beat them, but not them. And that unification of speech, melody, and what he said, I said, you know, that's it. Because by repetition, and if you let it go long enough, you'll hear as the sort of two voices separate into kind of a canon or round, yeah, it becomes more musical, but you don't really lose the meaning of those words. As a matter of fact, they become sort of more emblematic and more powerful as they become abstract. They become kind of like a war cry or, you know, a battle cry. And it was used, the world premiere of the piece was as Pass the Hat music in Town Hall in 1966 to raise money. And that was how it was the piece was first heard.
Mm-hmm. The party going on here this month to celebrate your 70th birthday is, you know, all the major cultural institutions are in on it. And it gets started tonight with BAM and with the dancers, with the choreographers. Anna Teresa de Kirschmacher, who's done a lot of work with your music.
She has.
And Akram Khan. Now, you wrote in your book, Writings on Music, 1965 to 2000, that dancers understand your work perhaps best of all, or maybe they were the first to understand it because of the rhythm, the rhythmic elements.
Well, I think, you know, dance needs an energy cell, and the energy cell is music, and it always has been, except for a brief period in the John Cage era when people were, you know, leaving that alone. But as soon as their dance party, as soon as their dance concerts were over, everybody go to the party, turn on the rock and roll, and really dance. So it never really stopped. And, I mean, I don't write rhythmic music so that dancers will dance to it. I write rhythmic music because I was a drummer when I was 14. That just seems to be part of who I am. But as a result, I have turned out to be, you know, widely choreographed. And these two dances that will be seen at BAM tonight and for the rest of the week are wildly different by wildly different choreographers. Although Akram Khan is much younger, and he studied Kathak,
South Indian dance. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and then he studied with Anna Teresa. He was actually one of her students up at her school in Brussels. So he's a very curious amalgam of someone with a traditional Indian background and who's become a really, I think, important modern dancer with a sort of a theatrical flair. And Anna Teresa Kirschmacher is really a genius. And the piece she's doing, Faza, which is from the early 80s, was the piece that sort of put her on the map. And I never saw it. She wrote me a letter back in 1980. One or two, and I just remember getting this envelope with this woman with this enormously long name, you know, who I'd never heard of, saying, "Could I use your musicians live in a piece I'd like to do in Europe?" And I went to the musicians, Ed
Neiman and Nari Tillis.
Ed Neiman and Nari Tillis. Thank you. I'm a little slum in the morning here. And I said, "Look, you know, you guys want to go on tour with this Belgian dancer who not do anything?" And they said, "Sure." So when they got back, I said, "Well, how was it?" They said, "You got to see this woman. She's incredible." So it took 16, I saw actually some other pieces of her and I was very impressed and I met her and I was very impressed, but it wasn't until 16 years later at the kitchen that I finally saw the piece Faza that she had made this music, and my jaw dropped open and I thought, you know, wow. And that's p- piece that's being done tonight. And I really must say, I think it's a masterpiece.
All right. Steve Reich is my guest. And the special webpage that we've put together on our website at WNYC.org has a full listing of all the different concerts going on at BAM and Carnegie Hall, Lincoln Center, the Whitney, everything that's going on around town. The UR Variations is being performed October 28th at
yes.
Lincoln Center. That'll be its New York premiere. Odd title. I know we talked about this last time you were here, but you know where did the UR Variations come from?
Well, basically, it came from looking for short texts. A couple of years back, I did a piece called Proverb, and the whole text was from Ludwig Wittgenstein, and it went, "How small a thought it takes to fill a whole life." And I loved having this kind of mantra-like text that you could just keep turning and keep turning and keep turning. So when the time came for this larger piece, I thought, well, I'm going to find text like that. And I started looking in Judaic sources. And one of the sources I looked in was Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who's one of the most sort of magnetic and attractive and interesting of the 18th century mystics. He died in 1810. And he says basically, well, translated, he says, "You are wherever your thoughts are." And that's certainly true of all of us.
And this excerpt, this is, I think this is the fourth movement, which is
yes.
another of the Hebrew texts.
This text is Emor Ma'at V'aseh Harbeh, which in English is say little and do much.
And this is the L.A. Master Chorale and some recent music by my guest, Steve Reich. A little bit of the music from Steve Reich's UR Variations, and actually a number of the short clips that we're hearing this afternoon, you can hear the full pieces tonight at 11 o'clock on New Sounds, a whole hour of Steve Reich's music as we continue to celebrate his 70th birthday here at WNYC today. So Lincoln Center is doing the New York premiere of this piece on October 28th. Carnegie Hall is doing some big educational events around your work as well.
Right.
I mean, you know, you're 70, you're not dead, but are you beginning to think about your legacy and what you're going to, you know, what kind of music, other than recordings of your own band, that might be
right. Well,
left
I think
behind?
That's a very good question. I think the thing that...
I could have phrased it a bit more elegantly, sorry.
No, it's right on the money. The thing that probably makes me happiest about what's been going on, actually for the last few years, is that if you go to my website or Boosie and Hawk's website and look under concerts of mine, you'll see, I don't know, 150, 200 concerts a year, this year even more because of the birthday. And you'll see my ensemble did two or three of them. And, you know, that means 197 were done by, you know, well, okay, the Kronos Quartet, the Ensemble Moderne, Maya Beiser, but then a whole lot of people I never heard of. I've taken trips to Riga, you know, in Eastern Europe and to Seoul in South Korea and found musicians who could not only play what I had written, but really play it with feeling and, you know, nuance and get it, you know, so you really wanted to hear it. You wanted to dance to it. And that, why? How is that possible? Well, time's on your side. I mean, imagine when Bartok wrote the fourth quartet back in the 1920s. And a lot of musicians looked at him and said, "Mr. Bartok, you're a great musician, but do you really expect us to play that?" So, you know, the Kolisch Quartet played it and the Prewarte Quartet, and nobody else could play it. But then a whole generation of musicians grew up. Their teachers showed up. Well, this is how you play a snap pizzicato. This is how it goes. They saw the score. Their teacher showed them how it went when they were 10 years old. They heard recordings. They heard performances. And lo and behold, by the time they got to be 20, they could play it. Nowadays, in the 21st century, you can't be a string quartet and not play Bartok. And if you speak to any musician, violinist, percussionist, whatever, and they'll tell you stories like, "My students can do things now that I couldn't do at their age, and my students can do things now that I can't even do."
Mm.
Each generation solves the technical problems of the previous generation at a much younger age and just looks at the pieces that you are having a problem with and says, "Wait, what's the problem?" And they just do it.
And so we have this younger generation of of DJs who have, I mean, what did you think when that Reich remixed album came out and you heard, you know, your musical children being kind of refracted through the prism of all these different DJs?
Well, that's another neck of the woods. We were talking about classical musicians and right. how they do it, but DJs, well, you know, I was a kid who was 14 years old and went to Birdland and you heard, you know, Kenny Clarke, the drummer, and Miles Davis and Bud Powell. And so that was like, 1950s. Then when I was at Juilliard and Mills College in the 60s, every time John Coltrane was in town, I went to hear him. Okay, now cut to 73, and we're playing in the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and after the concert's over, a guy comes up with long hair and lipstick and says, "How do you do? I'm Brian Eno." And I think, wow, poetic justice. A few years later, there come these DJs who just appropriate the music. And I tell you the truth, it makes me feel really good because these are people I hadn't even met, people who weren't even born when It's Gonna Rain and Come Out Were Done. And if they can find something interesting in it, you know, 30, 40 years later, you know, you're broadcasting on the radio. People don't listen to you. You're not going to feel good. I'm the same way. I'm writing music. If people don't listen to it, I'm not going to feel good. And if they are, I feel very good.
Well, you know, you mentioned Brian Eno, but also David Bowie, The Orb, Sonic Youth, Sufjan Stevens, and a whole host of DJs have fallen under the spell of Steve Reich's music. DJ Spooky in the background and his remix of your downtown piece called City Life. Steve, thank you so much for spending part of your birthday today with us here on Soundcheck. You know, it's you're no longer a neighbor now that you're up in Westchester, but always a friend of WNYC, and just great to see you again.
John, I'd like to thank you for years and years and years of support. It's been a pleasure, and it's great to see you, and I can't think of a better way to spend a birthday than starting it with you.
Well, thank you. Steve Reich, my guest on Soundcheck, celebrating his 70th birthday today. Check out the birthday page on our website at WNYC.org for photos, free MP3, concert calendar, and archived shows, WNYC.org. And stay with us for a live performance from the Brazilian Girls. They're not Brazilian, and only one of them's a girl, but they will be playing live for us in just a moment on Soundcheck.